This presentation was recorded at DevOps Days 2010 in Mountain View, California. This audio file and others like it are available for free download on InfoQ.com.
This is a talk about use cases, about the good, the bad, the ugly, and ideas for the future. I'll let everyone introduce themselves and their experience with DevOps, and then we'll get into the discussion.
All right, howdy. I'm Ernest Muller from National Instruments in Austin, Texas. Anybody?
Woo!
Yeah. I've been in web operations for a long time, like since 93, worked at places like FedEx, small shops, and over probably about the last 5 years, we've been trying to implement a lot of these same concepts in our shop, and now that there's a lovely name to go with it, I know where to go show up and talk about it.
Hi, I'm Kevin Ray from PowerViews. I don't seem to have made the slide. PowerViews.
Who QA'd that?
PowerViews is a software as a service platform for product reviews, online reviews. The reason I'm here is I sent an email to somebody who was asking for people who are interested in this stuff, and I've been following the space for a while, and I've been using Puppet since, 3-4 years ago, and it's pretty tough when you're outnumbered. There's a lot more developers than there are operations folks, and wanted to see who the tribe was.
I'm Dan Nemec. I'm from Silverpop in Atlanta. I've been in the software as a service space for since the early 90s as well, and I've been mostly on the ops side, and just over the last couple of years moved into the dev side and just learning both sides of the camp, and I've gotten to know Damon, and he invited me here. I'm really nobody special, but I've been a DevOps person for 10 plus years and just love to see the community and want to help contribute.
Hi, I'm Burr, an engineer. I'm with Shopzilla. We are a shopping comparison search engine site, and I've been in this space for about 20 years, 10 of which are on the dev side, and the last half is on the ops side. Shopzilla is a hardcore Scrum Agile shop, and 2 years ago we adopted trying to bring Scrum into the operational world to gel closer with the DevOps style, and I wanted to just open up that as a conversation for this room to see how that's working for other people and gather some thoughts around that process.
Yeah, hi, everybody. My name is Stefan Oppitz. I'm in production operations here at LinkedIn. Been with the company for about 3 years, and I can say that during the duration of those 3 years, the one thing that we've constantly been going back and forth on and trying to resolve and work through is our release process. And I believe strongly that the whole DevOps concept as an umbrella concept really manifests itself in the way you hand off between development and operations. It all comes together within the release process. And it's something where, again, we've been working on for some time, and we still have a ways to go in terms of automation and in terms of sort of embedding development concepts within the operations organization. And that's why I'm here today, and I've been learning a lot from talking to you folks. And it's been very good.
So far, we've had a panel about culture and tools, and I feel like this is kind of where they mix together, what we're trying to talk about. And I'd like to hear, since we're sort of on a shortened time frame, let's skip the good and let's get to the bad. So I want to hear some things that you thought would work and then they didn't work very well.
Well, one thing that I've gone from the ops department to dev, and now I've become the bad guy, and my ops department won't speak to me anymore. And I'm trying to figure out why. And one of the talks at Velocity talked about sysadmin 2.0, and it seems like our ops department is a sysadmin 1.0 department. And
you're not API compatible.
Yeah, they have do it five, and that's how part of deployments run, is we got do it five, do it six, do it seven. And so I'm here learning how to get a sysadmin 1.0 department to a sysadmin 2.0 department. And
you just push the deploy button.
Push the deploy button. So that's not an answer, but that's one of the one of the big challenges and that I'm looking at.
I'm gonna steal the mic since I was in the way. So I put Puppet in at my organization, and we were a sysadmin team of two people. I've done sysadmin for 10 years, and I've done it long enough to know that I don't like to do things over and over again, repeatedly, manually. So putting in something like Puppet seemed like a big win. It seemed self-evident to me. However, that's not the case for everyone. What do you mean? I just want to edit this one file. What do you mean I have to write a whole module and check into version control and do all this stuff? You know, there's a cultural difference between some of the folks who have that job and who've done that for a long time, and you have to bring them along. It's an interesting process.
Yeah, that's very true. I think what we found is the biggest hindrance to us uptaking these things isn't really the divide between dev and ops. It's other ops people, right? I mean, just to be blunt, right? As an ops guy. And it was the same thing when agile development started, right? It's like, you know, when people started trying to do agile development, was it the business people they were trying to engage that were telling them no? No, it was other developers who were like, that's crazy talk, waterfall man, read the Software Engineering Institute stuff, you're being crazy. And I think it's doing that, kind of getting that culture changed within the operations or infrastructure, as we call them in big enterprises, folks to really get on board with the newer concept. So I think we can be our own worst enemy if we let ourselves be.
How many folks over here have an agile shop?
What is cloud computing?
How many folks even try agile within operations? Awesome. So we've been doing agile and scrum in operations for a while, although some of us would say that we do more of a bastardized version of it. But the success rate that we have is between 70 and 80% on average, right? And the needle never pushes above that. And I'm more of an introspective sociology, psychology kind of guy, so I always look at why and how. And I think I've narrowed it down to personality of the people that work in operations versus those that work in development. And a person who thrives on a queue refuses to work on or mentally is blocked from working on a specific task. He would much rather knock off a ticket and move on to the next ticket than actually. So my question to this group is, do you guys face anything like that? And if so, what are some of the things you do or as a group that we should do in order to have more DevOps, right? And I have some solutions that I want to try, but how many people over here have heard of Kanban? Yeah. I think that pretty much sums it up in terms of bringing a version of Scrum into operations, and I would love to have some people who do use Kanban to talk about their experiences, specifically as it relates to the psychology of an operator.
So again, when I we spoke to a bunch of the folks over at DTO, and when they came in and did some consulting work with us, the key thing that struck me as, or struck us as an organization as problematic is when you have an agile organization within engineering, and we they produce products, and then we try to deploy them in an agile manner within operations. We wind up falling into the trap where we just don't have the tools in place right now, right? And so we've been working for some time on trying to get a level of automation within the operations organization, and we are now finally getting to a point where we have a product called that we've internally built called Glue that we're rolling out, and that's been helping us quite some bit.
I'm going to editorialize just a bit, because I feel like in a lot of organizations you have agile in the development process, and then deployment is a waterfall step. And then with respect to Kanban, I think that's it maps much more effectively onto ops work, where you're managing flow. Because if you have interrupt-driven things you respond to, it's hard to follow, and you get in this. I think it's actually bad for morale when you do sprints and you've committed to release a certain thing, and then that 2 weeks is gone, and it's like we didn't get that done because we stayed up till 3 a.m. And that's, I think, that transferring that and making that visible, where you had interrupt-driven work, and that goes into the flow, and you saw, okay, well, we didn't get our projects done, but we were actually contributing, and making that transparent all the way back up to the management.
Bingo. I think that pretty much nails it.
Problem solved. So one of the things that I thought was interesting about So one of the things I thought was interesting about all the answers until the very end was we were all basically talking about cultural impedance, not necessarily a technology problem. I'd also like to hear if any of you have had a spectacular technology failure in your attempts to do this.
Well, if I could talk to the culture part of it real quick, I think it is tremendously important, right? I mean, it's something that it's easy to say, but it's hazy to understand what that really means. But to share a little bit of not even tech-related stuff, so National Instruments, right, were always rated one of whatever the Fortune magazine 100 best places to work for and all that, and the at least internal story as to why that is we try actively to maintain our corporate culture, right? Like, it's not some passive thing that just emerges. Well, a culture will emerge, but it's not a culture you want. It's easy to have a good culture when you're all 21 and you're and you got plenty of free drinks and there's 20 people in your company, right? It's easy to have a fun culture then. Once you're, a 5,000-person global company and just a lot of big stuff, and you have Sarbanes-Oxley auditors in, right? It's harder to have a good culture unless you actually treat that culture as a physical artifact, as something that you are working on developing, and you have people whose job is to make sure, to think about your company and
its
5-year plan,
10-year
plan.
So did you have a spectacular technology failure?
Oh, sure.
Well, we're going to get to lunch fast, so let's get everyone into the discussion. Let's hear some things from the audience. Ben, get through the mic if you want to say something.
Yeah, technology failure.
We'll come back to
it. Spectacular enough.
Let's hear.
I've been trying to also apply things like Scrum in operations and Kanban, and one of the, like you mentioned, differences was the interrupt-driven thing, but also like operational people tends to be specialists in certain fields. So there's the storage guy, there's like the network guy, and so on. And it seems like in software, they're trying to get more generalists into their teams. Is that something you experienced too, or how do you cope with that?
I think we have specialist storage networks and systems, and it's true that in the dev world you have generalists. But even if you dig within that, there will be the architect versus the senior guy versus the junior guy who's working, right? So one guy is doing maintenance while the other guy is on the forefront of doing something. So it's not that different. But what we have done is that we have just broken up and have separate iterations for the network team, systems team, and storage team. That seems to work for us.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm Strata Chalup, recently of Linden Lab, Second Life. We spent 18 months building an enterprise product and spent about half of it using Scrum, the latter half. And what we found worked very well for us was essentially to consider the standalone version a separate product. And we pulled team members in. We went out to QA. We went out to support. We went out to operations and said, give us your point person on this who will come to our scrums. And when we built up the sprint list, we also let the other stakeholder groups put tasks on it and made those part of the sprint. That avoided that kind of post-sprint depression of we built all this and didn't get it done, because releasing it was actually part of the sprint, getting through a full series of integration tests. And using this method, we basically put out 6 releases under tight time pressure over 18 months with a total slip of only 11 days. And I'm happy to talk to people about it, talk about what worked and what didn't for us.
Very nice.
That's awesome.
Actually, something related to that. I think one of the tricks for an operations person to get used to when you start moving into the iterative development model is deciding that a lot of features don't have to be implemented, right? Like that's actually one of the biggest mindset changes. We tend to have this perfectionist kind of view. It's like, well, I need to build the system. I need to performance tune it. I need to security harden it. I need to put all the stuff on it. I need, you know, and I can't ship a completed product until that's the case, right? But then you start working with developers doing Agile, and they're just like, that's not going to make this iteration. Yeah, it's out of there. It's for some future release, right? And it takes a little bit for you to become okay with thinking like that. It's like, oh, I'm not going to have that VPN tunnel working in this iteration. Well, don't, you know, system's going to work without it. Fuck it, right? I mean, you have to get to where you can say that.
Go ahead.
Right. Yeah. You know, one thing I've been hearing a lot. You know, we definitely keep going right back into culture, and I think one of the things, you know, you'll be surprised to hear the word ITIL mentioned. You know, with Agile, but there are some good things about it. One thing that I found that I was perplexed about, like, you know, this concept of problem engineering versus problem management, and you know, your typical operations folks who have been very successful in traditional operations role are very good at managing the problem, and their behavior has been reinforced by you know getting that raise or whatever for the 7 years, and you're basically, as a manager, you're asking this person who has become like the top shit at managing this stuff, who probably by virtue of doing that has stepped so far away from the development world that they feel very uncomfortable, to then say, you know, okay, you know, where's your path? So I think that, you know, part of the whole idea of getting DevOps to work is to look at, you know, where these people are coming from and not alienate, you know, provide them a path to success. And that way you've got the person who knows how, you know, you've gotten there, you know, that, and that you don't get this situation with this sort of like the cluster that blows up one node by node because it's out of memory, where like each person quits because, you know, the person's, you know, alienated, they're back there, they're doing more work, and then, you know, all that happens. So like, you need to put your organization on a career path to get to DevOps, and that includes looking at all the people that are existing in there and not just, you know, shying them off and saying, you know, you're an ops guy. Because that's where you're bred, and you know, you got to embrace your people.
Yeah, that was something that I was thinking about last night. Someone said in one of the talks, your sysadmins are great developers, but a lot of them don't know the development tools. They don't have the development background. And so for an education is teach them how to use source control, that it's their friend, and teach them some of the development practices that have been around for 20 years that developers, it's just natural for them. And if you can get your sysadmins to have some of those practices, then they can think more like developers, and that helps bring the two teams together.
We don't do enough already, but so a legitimate question. I'm really curious, where did the seeds in your organization come from that kind of brought you to where you are today with the DevOps idea and integration and all that? did it start with engineers, or did you guys as managers just have infinite foresight and you decided, guys, this is what we're going to do? I mean, was it from the bottom up, top down, devs on the side? Where did that start?
Well, in my organization right now, it's me. So I've seen both sides, and then as soon as I heard the DevOps term, I said, that's something I can grasp. I've felt that. I've thought that for years, and so I'm trying to be an evangelist to both sides of the house in my organization. So it's really starting from a point and trying to grow.
I'd like to hear some other.
In our organization, it started bottom up, and we were also limited by the number of people we could hire, so it was a survival mechanism. When I started, every server was different, and we had to go and refactor things so they would still work, yet have a repeatable process that could scale without people.
I was just going to say, so in our case, it was, I would say, definitely from the engineering side, again, trying to get more done, get more product out, and getting us to a point where we could deliver against that. So I believe we've been talking about the overall concepts of DevOps for some time, certainly as long as I've been here. And it's refreshing to see that everything is, all those concepts, whether it's, you know, continuous integration, et cetera, deployment automation, is starting to come together under one umbrella term. And it's a very useful sort of framework for people within both organizations now to refer to and to strive towards. So in our case, it's been myself, but overall also the engineering teams who've been pushing it mainly.
So back to culture, which is one of my favorite topics. One of the things that I love about DevOps is that what most people seem to realize pretty quickly is that it is not a piece of technology. It is not a process. It is not any of these things, but it is fundamentally culture. And you can get that right or wrong, and the difference is whether the different outcome is whether you are successful with that is based on your culture. So to your point about it's very easy to have a good culture when you're 20 people and your kids and all that sort of stuff, I don't think so. The difference between a big company and a little company is, in a little company, it's really easy to change your culture if it's bad, but it's almost impossible to tell that it's bad. Right? You're moving so quickly, you're staying up late, you're packed into tiny rooms with these people all day, and you can't tell the difference between your stress and you're hating the guy next to you because he's a jerk. You know, there's no context, you can't tell. In a huge company, everybody knows when the culture's broken, but you can't change it, right? It's almost impossible. That's the problem. At the point that you can tell it's broken, you can't really fix it anymore. I have actually never heard of a major company changing its culture. So the question that a lot of people have about what happens when founder X leaves successful company Y, you know, they're so important as a leader, the actual thing that those people tend to bring to the table is that they're hyper-focused all the time on culture. So Amazon, Microsoft under Bill Gates and decidedly not under Ballmer, right? That is a different culture. All that happened was that the person at the top changed, and their sort of temple of culture changed to a different god, and that one doesn't work, right? That's all that happened because it was the same people. They had all the same stuff. They had all the same money, but their culture was suddenly different. And so the fundamental point I want to make is when you are tiny, focus on almost nothing but culture because you will never have another chance.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And one of the flaws I think we have in terms of technical organizations is we read a lot of Dilbert strips, and we think management is essentially an undesirable thing, right? You know, management is the hateful thing. We're all techies. We're going to figure it out. And as a result, when we have a techie that becomes a manager or whatever, we spend too much time doing technology and not enough time engineering the things like culture and our people that actually manage a lot more to the organization than you know, going and kickstarting a box yourself.
I will start from problems, as we were discussing before, and go to some kind of solutions. So, as previous man said about growing up companies, so when started from startup, then growing up. And probably this culture was optimal for that startup. But later some problems started, you know, like overtime, like more and more layers and professional managers who doesn't know well ops and development. So some conflict started between them, you know. And many other problems that indicate that this structure, procedures, functions, probably hardware, software, configurations, way of doing business, you know, they are already suboptimal for this new structure of organization. My question is, how do you solve these problems? What is trigger for starting optimization? Because very often managers try to optimize, not to optimize, but to automate what they already do. So they have problems, and now they decide these problems automate. So they will be automatical, you know. Yeah, so the question is, what triggers the process of optimization? When you say, okay, we don't need to automate existing mess, we need to reorganize and optimize. What's the trigger?
So I think it's a question of as you institutionalize technical debt in your infrastructure, and I think you can have technical debt or debt in your culture debt. I think that's sort of what he's asking, right?
Well, I'm an optimist, so I'm going to give the unicorn answer to that question. Is it does have to come from the executives. I mean, we have a VP of development and a VP of operations, and if they don't, if their performance metric, I mean, if their pay isn't tied to culture, then I don't know. I mean, then you get in that pessimistic. It won't change if they're not incented to bring the culture together. I don't know if it can change.
Is your culture partition tolerant?
Well, our we have a great CEO, and I think he is capable of managing the culture at the executive level, which will trickle down and which will let DevOps work in the organization. But it does. I think it has to start that high.
I say start with the problem. If there is any downtime, if there was any occurrence where the systems were out, start with that, you know, iterate on that, look at how you can come together as a group to understand what happened without blame, but more as to what exactly happened and how do we prevent it from happening again. And that will lead you down that path.
Like the gentleman a few sessions before. Just a book. How many of you guys have read Jim Collins' From Good to Great? So I find that book like really, really good to read, whether you're a manager or not. It kind of talks a lot about observing successful organizations, whether they're in technology or not, and how they've kind of built a company, not just around leaders, but organizations that persevere being great over time. So just check it out. It may help some.
So we're time constrained, so let's take one more comment, and then we'll do our closing, and then we'll get some food.
I would like to make two pragmatic offers to this discussion about culture and culture change. First, don't try to change the culture, change the behavior. It will take you 10 years to change a culture, and you don't have this time. Instead, focus within the culture on behavioral changes. Second things I would like to offer is, let me take half a minute to put it right, you know, to put it right in my head. Let me just stay with the first one. Don't change the culture, change the behavior.
Thank you. So let's just start with Ernest and go down the row.
All right. I think it's obviously an exciting time, right? And there's a lot of change. We're seeing these concepts that we're kind of wrapping under the term DevOps coming together. And to kind of respond to the 16-hour thing in the previous panel, so it's not about the tools, right? It's about the culture and all that, but I think what we're seeing is the tools and the computing environment are helping to catalyze change, right? So in my hotel room last night, History Channel was doing a thing on the Civil War, right, and the introduction of the mini-ball in the rifles. And, you know, everybody used the same tactics and processes that they had previously with the new tools, and the slaughter was profound, right? And we're getting these new tools. We're getting cloud computing. We're getting all these lovely automation tools. And if we keep using them in the same way that we have been,
the slaughter will be profound,
right? And we have to adapt our tactics.
I never want to stand between anyone and lunch. So let's eat.
I'm just encouraged by the community that has formed, and I hope we can keep the community going and keep the dialogue and keep learning from each other.
Don't be afraid of change. You don't have to be part of the herd. If something doesn't work for you, don't be afraid to say, screw it, I'll try something else. If it's not DevOps, coin your own word. Go BizOps, you know. Screw development, go directly to business. Try whatever works for your organization.
Couldn't agree more with that. Also, the Israel's comment about don't change the culture, change the behavior. Absolutely true. I think that's very, very good. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank the panel. I'd like to thank everyone else for being here.